63 Urbana.
All right. Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, March 7th, 2010, here on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a program that goes in a slightly different direction than what we've done the last several weeks in the program. We'll be talking to an expert on documentary film, public media, and intellectual property, and talking about what the internet means for our understanding of copyright, for entertainment, and for programming, and what we can do about it. We have a great show in line with Patricia Ofterhardy of American University. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show with us. But before we go to our guests, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Comcast and NBC executives were back in Congress last week to testify at a House Judiciary Committee hearing. Comcast CEO Brian Roberts and NBC's Jeff Zucker claimed that the proposed merger of the two companies would strengthen the industry and would not lead to layoffs. But Larry Cohen, president of the Communications Workers of America, wasn't impressed.
The bottom line, the public must be protected from the significant harms created by a combination of such unprecedented scale. A Comcast-NBC combination will, in fact, lead to the loss of good jobs. In any of these restructurings, there's never a warranty on employment, only promises.
Cohen says that to pay for the debt incurred in this deal, the merged company will have two choices: cut jobs or raise cable prices. He worries the deal will also harm workers who keep their jobs.
Unfortunately, Comcast has a terrible track record of aggressive action to eliminate collective bargaining at the companies that it acquires.
Gene Pruitt, the president of the Independent Film and Television Alliance, also took issue with the merger. She called independent producers the workhorses of the industry, who are responsible for 70% of feature films and 63% of Oscar winners.
The issue before us today is whether America will continue to be informed, entertained, and challenged by varied voices. The answer matters. Independent TV series and films have changed how Americans think, how we live, and how we structure our society.
Pruitt cited films like The Hurt Locker and Precious and TV shows like The Cosby Show that challenge audiences. A Comcast-NBC merger would continue the 15-year trend of consolidation that is squeezing independent producers out of the industry.
Comcast is buying NBC so that it can own more TV shows and more feature films. They look forward to cost savings. They look forward to synergies as they fuel new platforms. But this will come from the capacity to leverage their own programming across many platforms, from free TV to cable to video on demand to the internet. They avoid the transaction costs, they say, of having to deal with third parties or independents in acquiring that programming.
The public shouldn't be denied access to new messages and new messengers, says Pruitt.
A handful of executives now decide how, when, and whether programs will reach the public. They're closing the door on diversity, and we must do whatever we can to pry that door open today. Make no mistake, what's good for Comcast and NBC in this merger isn't good for the American public.
And now for some Media Minutes updates. Stanford law professor and intellectual property scholar Lawrence Lessig gives frequent lectures on fair use and the free culture movement, which seeks to overhaul copyright law to increase creativity and innovation. Last week, Lessig gave a video lecture that was viewed by people across the globe who gathered to participate in the discussion on remix culture. As if to punctuate the very problems that concern Lessig about copyright, YouTube removed the audio from the lecture because of an alleged copyright infringement by Warner Music Group. YouTube's automated tool, Content ID, searches for copyrighted content and removes it. The Electronic Frontier Foundation has pointed out on their blog that while, quote, reasonable minds can differ about whether a particular use of a song qualifies as fair use, that's no excuse for the automated Content ID filter to block them. EFF and others have strongly criticized YouTube's computerized copyright screening for removing humans from the takedown process. Fair use requires an assessment based on context that is not possible to automate. This is not the first time that a Lessig lecture on copyright has been unceremoniously removed. Last year's lecture was taken down, too. In a publicity stunt effort to attract investment in a super-fast fiber network by the search engine giant, the city of Topeka, Kansas has temporarily renamed itself Google. Google is hoping the move will entice the other Google to pick the city as one of the sites for the gigabit per second experimental networks that the company has promised to roll out and test to some 500,000 users across the country. While the name change will only last for 1 month, the move sparked the mayor of Duluth, Minnesota, to endorse a video parody proclaiming that all firstborn males and females in the city will be renamed Google and Googlet Fiber. While the pandering and parodies have attracted significant press, the hunger for faster speeds and more connections is real. Topeka Mayor Bill Bunton told reporters he believes that kind of investment in infrastructure could keep young people in the community and attract business.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, March 7th, 2010, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is Professor Pat Ofterheide from the School of Communication at American University in Washington, D.C. She is the head of the Center for Social Media, which is based at American University, and the author of numerous books, including Documentary, a Very Short Introduction, published by Oxford University Press in 2007. Pat Ofterheide, welcome to Media Matters.
Hey, thank you, Bob. So are you going to watch the Oscars tonight?
Well, I'm going to alternate between watching them and a basketball game, so I'm going to take advantage of new technology to watch both.
The best of all possible worlds. Oh, I was just looking at the list thinking, it's shocking that I have not seen so many of these films, but I have to tell you, I am in love with the documentary choices, and I wish they would not put the documentaries all the way at the end because it means I can't stay up and watch them. But, in a situation where often with the highest level entertainment, you've got terrific concentration of media. One of the exciting things about watching documentaries is that it does allow for so many diverse voices. I mean, if you take a look at the documentary features, you've got The Most Dangerous Man in America, which is a marvelous, marvelous film about Dan Ellsberg mm-hmm. and what he did. And you know, this is the guy who gave us the phrase controlled stupidity. Because mm-hmm. they said, why did you wait so long to release the Watergate papers, and how do other people put up with it? How do people put up with this impossible situation for so long? And he said, controlled stupidity. Anyway, this movie's great. Food, Inc., which is, about the corporate...
Yeah, I've seen that one.
Food. Yeah, The Cove, which is, I don't personally like, but it's a scary film about what the Japanese are doing to dolphins. And Burma Vijay, which is an amazing film about how these Burmese monks and dissidents used new technology, Skype, cell phones, to capture resistance to the Burmese military and get it out into the world and onto the BBC and CNN. So I just think if you could stay up, I'd stay up for the documentary part of the Oscars.
Well, Pat Ofterheide, that begs the question, is this always what happens with documentaries? We just largely overlook these great films every year? Or are we in some sort of golden age or renaissance of the documentary?
Well, I would say it's definitely a golden age. There's never been so many... It's a golden age for consumers, for sure. I mean, there's never been so many really good documentaries being made from so many different sources. I mean, Burma Vijay was made by... Scandinavians with Scandinavian state money. The Cove was made by a nonprofit with membership money. The Most Dangerous Man in America was made sort of the old-fashioned way, where the filmmakers raise money, get money from foundations, and hope to recoup the money at the other end. Food Inc. I think is had some public television money. So you've got a diversity of ways of funding. You've got some crowdsourcing options. You've got a lot of ways to see them. Netflix does, this is not something that's well known, but Netflix does a huge amount of business out of its documentaries. Now, admittedly, most of them are sports and entertainment and celebrity documentaries, but it also has a fantastic list of the kinds of documentaries I really care about, social documentaries. Now, from a viewpoint of the traditional documentary maker who wants to get their work on television and be paid in advance, I think it's a much harder environment because the budgets are going down. And there's people's eyeballs are moving all over the landscape. So the traditional world of television is no longer the only game in town, and it can be hard to make. On the other hand, the opportunities are really amazing.
Have the new technologies lowered the cost of production for documentary filmmakers too?
They definitely did, and they introduced they basically took a lot of the need for high level professionalism at every step of the way out. So now anybody can be a documentarian, which drives some of the traditional professionals nuts.
Our guest, Pat Ofterheide from American University, where she's a professor in the School of Communication. We're talking right now about the Oscars and documentary film, but we'll also be talking during this whole hour about the work of her Center for Social Media at American University, which is doing some of the trailblazing work on fair use and copyright and seeing how intellectual property does and does not apply to the digital era. Really important stuff. It will be the content of much of the show. But while we're on the subject of documentaries, Pat Ofterheide, I mean, is there something that we could do as a society to enhance documentary filmmaking? Are there policies? Are there things that Congress could do? Or is this simply sort of an area like painting where you just sort of sit back and hope that the artists can find their way?
Well, there's no such thing as people just finding their way. There's always subsidies hidden or not built into any kind of cultural production. But I think that highly commercial documentaries are going to do what they're going to do just fine. Advocacy documentaries are going to do just fine. Brave New Films, which is Robert Greenwald's outfit, is doing some really remarkable work, working with nonprofit organizations, unions, and wealthy funders, attracting funds for particular targeted advocacy films. The films that I think I've always been most interested in, the social documentaries that point to not just the news headlines, but the important underlying issues, and that have enduring value, I think have always depended on some kind of subsidy, and it has often come out of the very small pool we have for cultural funding in this society, from the NEH, the National Endowment for the Humanities, NEA, National Endowment for the Arts, the state arts councils, the state humanities councils, and probably the biggest single pool is public television and public radio. And I don't want to slight public radio at all, because I think radio documentary is really an amazing form. And all you have to do is listen to Radio Lab or This American Life to know that that's true. So the funding, the question I have, the policy question I have going forward for documentary is what kinds of funds will we as a society make available, and what kinds of policies will we have around them to encourage people to make those documentaries that really are a public intervention. They're an invitation not only to public knowledge but to public action. I have to say that as somebody who's spent way too much time in my life looking at public television, I feel like, you know, I know acronyms that were retired before my students were born. But I think public television has never paid that much attention to social documentary. So the any largesse that has come to social documentary has kind of come at the edges of whatever else public television was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And to some degree, that's true of public radio, but not so much, because public radio has always been much more interested in journalism. So I think the policy question is, how will we support that kind of discourse through documentary, as well as through other things, and how will public media, as it changes and evolves, will public media be able to fund truly diverse voices,
mm-hmm.
people who, you know, you're not so likely to hear from? Because one of the achievements of public media in general has been civility, the ability to raise important issues in a non-Glenn Beck way. And that's something we should not throw out. And I actually would like to know what you think about that, because I think you're also somebody who spent a lot of time in your life focusing on how we get true public discussion.
Well, let's follow up on this point you were just raising about public broadcasting, Pat, because one thing I don't know that I think you do know the answer to is, compared to other industrial nations, how the U.S. fares in terms of funding documentaries through its public TV system. The ones you mentioned, at least one or two of them, got their funding from either America, for the nominees for Best Documentary, got their funding from either American or foreign public television broadcasters.
Mm-hmm.
In Germany, in Norway, Britain, Canada, are there in general greater funds available to produce documentaries by the national public broadcasters?
Well, absolutely there are. I'm not sure that makes them more enlightened or better, because I think they have different reasons for doing it. I think the lack of much cultural policy in the U.S. has a direct relationship with the fact that we have such an imperial commercial entertainment complex.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a large motivation around the funding for documentaries in other countries is that they're much cheaper to fund than commercial films, but they have a big cultural footprint internationally. And so when Norway is funding, and it does fund a lot of documentary films, the motivation of the state is to make sure that Norway is recognized internationally as a cool place and a place that actually has Norwegian culture. Now, nobody's confused in the United States about whether they have American culture. So you know, I think cultural mm-hmm. nationalism propels a lot of that funding,
mm-hmm.
and people who live within it have their own criticisms of it for tending toward the bland and the predictable, and creating a kind of provincial submarket. So it's not like that funding alone is the answer, but it's definitely true that we, in this country, we spend very, 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 very little on, compared to other countries, on our national television systems and our national radio systems.
Our guest today, Pat Ofterheide, professor at the School of Communication at American University, the head of the Center for Social Media, also based out of American University, author of many books and documentary on communications policy, and expert on a number of areas. And what we're going to turn to now and talk about for a while is some of her recent work at the center and her own work, which concerns intellectual property and copyright and fair use and its importance today. But, and Pat, before we get into the details or into the deep weeds here, I suspect there are some of our listeners who've heard terms like copyright, intellectual property, but don't really know what they mean. I mean, they sort of know what they mean, but they don't really know that much. Let's start really at the beginning. What is copyright? Where does it come from? What's its point? What's it supposed to do?
Well, first of all, let me agree with you. I actually started this project 6 years ago with a brilliant law professor named Peter Jassy. And his name is spelled with a J. It's Hungarian, so everybody thinks he's maybe Navajo, but really he's Hungarian-American. But Peter Jassy is an international copyright expert, and I have been amazed at the level of my own confusion going into the project. So I do believe that most people are less well-informed than they think they are, and that's partly because I think we've had an extremely unproductive national public conversation about copyright. And sometimes this is referred to as the copyright wars. So if you want to, I'm just going to be really simplistic about this. You have like the copyrightists versus the copyleftists. So you've got the copyrightists, which would be like Viacom, Universal, large content companies that are very alarmed by downloading and other ways that their business models are threatened. And they see copyright as a policy that's all about ownership.
It's a property right issue.
It's a property right issue, and it's all about owning the stuff. And And so what they want to do is tell everybody that taking other people's property is theft, and only bad people do it, and that the economy of our nation is propelled by our intellectual property, which circumnavigates the globe, you know, so Avatar goes everywhere. And in fact, there is a lot of money that comes into this country from, you know, one of the few things we actually export, which is our intellectual property goods. And then the copy leftists come in and say, copyright is terrible because it keeps culture away from being used because people can't get at it to make new culture. And as Larry Lessig says, remix culture is the actual nature of culture, which I personally agree with. I believe that all culture is made from some culture. Just to simplify their point of view, people who insist on greedily hoarding their culture are greedy, awful, bad. And what we need to do is to create copyright-free zones or copyright-light zones like Creative Commons and live there in a world which is better and full of nicer people. And to me, this polarization is unhelpful to the rest of us because it mistakes what copyright actually is, which finally I'm answering your question. I'm sorry.
It's quite all right. Take all the time you want. This is the joy of having a show on NPR.
Exactly. And at a really great station, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Remember that on Pledge Drive Week, all listeners.
Yep, and I believe that WIR has primacy, like it was the first station of some kind.
There's a few of them that claim to be the first. We're one of them, and I think we're right.
Absolutely you are. And I'll say that to the other guys, too. But anyway, back to the copyright definition. What copyright is a set of policies, a bundle of policies that are designed to incentivize culture, to encourage people to make culture. And providing a limited monopoly to people who made it so that they can recoup money personally for them is one of the tools that it has. It's, by the way, a tool that Thomas Jefferson believed was a very, very bad tool, and he did not want to see it in this country. And James Madison actually agreed with him that monopolies were so bad that you should not... You should really try to avoid them wherever possible. But James Madison thought that if you had a monopoly that was highly limited and tailored, then you could use the good incentivating part of that tool and not suffer the worst of monopoly.
Now, Pat, if I can interrupt you, just to make this a little more concrete for a second, because this is such an important point. The idea back then in 1792 when the country was being founded was that if someone wrote a book and they had the book published and sold it and they did not have copyright protection of any kind, then someone else could read the book. Another printer could just print up the exact same book and sell it, and the original author wouldn't get paid for it. Is that right?
Well, and yes, and that is exactly what the United States allowed to happen for any book that was not published in the United States, even after we had copyright.
Yeah, into the 20th century.
Exactly. So the original notion of copyright, which is actually driven not by authors but by publishers, was all about books. It wasn't even about magazine articles, much less CDs or anything else, or posters. It was really just about books, and it was a deal, basically, that the British Parliament cut with publishers to say, you can have a little bit of protection to get more revenue so that you will publish more books that we like. It was actually a kind of semi-censorship thing with the Crown.
A tax on knowledge, I think it was called.
A tax on knowledge. Good.
Well, Pat, before you go on, I do want to let our listeners know that you're listening to Pat Ofterheide, professor at the School of Communication at American University, the head of the Center for Social Media. We're discussing copyright, fair use, public domain, and the digital revolution, how these things all fit together. If you'd like to call in and join us here at WILL AM 580, the telephone number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Pat Ofterheide, return, if you will, to our history, our very short history of copyright.
Right. In any case, if you think of copyright as a bundle of policies that incentivize culture, and you understand that the limited monopoly that owners have is only one of those tools, you've got a bunch of other ones. And at this moment, because we've let copyright overtake so many parts of culture, the most important tool that allows people access and limits that monopoly is called fair use. And fair use says you have the right to take other people's copyrighted work and use it under some circumstances if it benefits the society more than it hurts the private owner. And it's defined in a very vague way, but in practice it's interpreted by saying, did you take this other person's work in order to do something different to it, because it different with it? Because if you did, you didn't just take something from them without paying. You took something from them without paying, but then you made something new with it that's different and has a different function in the world. And then if you took that stuff from them and used it for a different function, did you only take what you need? Or did you take more than you need? If you took only what you needed and it has a new purpose, then basically it's fair use and it's fine. What a lot of people have trouble with in fair use is this idea that, in fact, it's not theft. It's not being a bad person to take other people's work without paying.
In fact, Pat, if I can interrupt you on that point, is because we have a lot of people in our audience who are either scholars or students. I mean, the entirety of academic research is predicated on the notion of fair use. It wouldn't exist without it.
Absolutely. That's right. And for many years, we never even, you know, it's like when that guy in the bourgeois gentleman, the play by Molière, says, oh, my gosh, I've been speaking prose all my life. You know, yeah, we've been speaking prose all our lives. We've been using fair use all of our lives. Only recently has it become important to assert it more, and that actually is because we've unbalanced our copyright law. We've made it much more owner-heavy, and we've made it harder. We've eliminated some of the other easy ways that people got access to culture.
And
now it's you know, we have a situation where people who do remixes and mashups believe that they're doing something criminal or illegal or dissident or oppositional, and all they're doing is really using their fair use rights completely legally.
It seems, Pat Ofterhardy, that we have two phenomena going on simultaneously that you're talking about. One is that the laws over the last several decades have become much more commercially driven by large commercial copyright owners to make fair use smaller and to protect the property rights. And then on the other hand, you have this technological revolution which makes it much more difficult for copyright to be enforced. Is that a fair way to put it?
I think that I think that's right. I think the digital changes put pressure on business models. And the people who were most pressured by changes in the business model went to copyright to save their bottom line. And that changed the nature of copyright because it became much, much, much more owner-heavy. And that's actually my big mantra these days is use your fair use rights. It's really, really important because it's now the major way that you can take individual action to fight back to rebalance copyright. And it's legal, and you can do it. And the reason why I'm so impressed with what people can do is because we've seen it happen. We've been at the center through our collaboration with our colleagues at Boston College of Law. We've created some codes of best practices with communities, artistic and creative and user communities, such as teachers, documentary filmmakers, remix people, online video people, archivists, to define within their community what do they mean by fair use, how do they use it, what are the situations they use it in, and what's the logic that they apply when they're in those situations. And they're very easy to read codes. That the documentary filmmakers, who were the first group of people to use this code, we were astonished to see the industry results. Because it's been 5 years now since that code came out, and we have seen films be made that would never be made, and not by individual independent filmmakers alone, by PBS, by IFC, by Sundance, by Court TV,
So, Pat, if I get you right here, what's happening is that you've developed a set of best practices, recommendations for how to use fair use, and these filmmakers and documentary makers have adopted them, and they've become much more bold in their use of fair use than they would have been in the past?
It's a 180-degree turn. Before we published that code of best practices, documentary filmmakers who absolutely need to quote copyrighted material in their documentary films licensed every single thing they did. If they filmed a family birthday party and somebody sang happy birthday, which is copyrighted, they went to Sonny Burchard and paid $2,000. Since the code came out, they understand why that is an appropriate fair use and why they don't have to pay that clearance cost. And at first we thought, oh, this is going to be really tough because the whole industry is set up to understand that you always have to clear everything. And what we're seeing now is that not only, you know, documentary filmmakers need insurance in order to get on television, and the insurance guarantees them against any mistakes they might have made in licensing. Insurers never covered fair use because they said nobody really knows what it is. It's too dangerous. It's too risky. What if somebody sues? On the basis of this community-developed set of practice guidelines, here's what we mean by fair use. In documentary film, the insurance industry, every single insurer in America for that kind of insurance now accepts fair use claims without an added payment. So we've seen real fundamental 180-degree switch, and we've seen I just love it when you have this is a free speech goal. This is a free speech issue for me. But in the industry, it's about lowering clearance costs. And you now have law firms all up and down the West Coast that specialize in fair use. And one of the biggest ones, which is Donaldson and Califf in Los Angeles, is serving major studios whose projects are now all being run through the question of how much money can they save by employing fair use.
Our guest, Pat Ofter-Hardy, you've just been listening to from American University, the head of the Center for Social Media, author of many books on documentary film, on media policy, and also an expert on fair use, public domain, intellectual property. We're talking with her about the digital revolution and what's going on today with copyright. The telephone number, 333-9455 here at WILL-AM 580, and our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Now, Pat Ofter-Hardy, this sounds great for people who are producers, documentary filmmakers, people who need to use other material that might be protected by copyright, but that they want to use it and they have a legal right to do so, that now they can do so in a way that they were afraid to do 5 years ago or 10 years ago. What does this mean for the average person who like has a website now, who doesn't have a sort of sophisticated capacity to sort of protect their interest, even understand their interest? Are they empowered by these best practice codes that they can do more than they were doing before?
I think it's a great question, and I think the answer is there's a lot. These codes of best practices have opened up a much bigger awareness, even beyond the community that they've worked in, about what's possible. And the logic of them is very similar from code to code, so that it's possible to not be in one of those communities and maybe be in an adjacent community and still understand much more what your fair use rights are. It still would be a great thing if bloggers got together to create a code of best practices in blogging so that when the newspapers say, wait, you took too much of our article, and that's bad, mm-hmm. the bloggers can say, here's the reason why I took just this much. Or they can say, you know, from now on, I have to make sure that I have a really good justification for what I took and explain that within the blog so that people understand what my new repurposing of this was. And I'm not just putting it here so that they don't have to click over to the Washington Post page. But it would be great if they had a code, and I don't think they're real hard to make. But even without that, I think these codes of best practices have vastly increased awareness. Unfortunately, there's a problem with the original formation I talked about of creating a copyright wars mentality, because I think a lot of people now believe that that if you're going to push back on these, I always think of them as the golems of culture, you know, sitting on their precious hoard of culture, the large content industry people. If you're going to push back against that mentality, you have to be, you have to criminalize yourself, or you have to indulge in pranksterism or some kind of valiant but futile behavior. And I think what we've got with the fair use activity is a real awareness that fair use is far less vague and far less unclear and certainly far less dangerous than it is being portrayed, both by the copyleft and the copyright.
Pat Ofterhardy, our guest today on Media Matters. If you want to see these codes of best practices that Pat Ofterhardy's been describing, you can go to the centerforsocialmedia.org website, centerforsocialmedia.org website, and you'll see the places to click under resources or fair use to get right to that material. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Pat Ofterhardy here on Media Matters, the number again, 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines for our caller now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Pat Ofterhardy.
Hello?
Yes, that's you.
Thank you. Appreciate the program today. I had a, it's not so much fair use. I mean, I've had a little bit of that dealings in the past. I'm an artist, and but my question today would be, could you talk a little bit about sort of peer-to-peer file sharing over the internet, and how I see it sort of as kind of a corollary of, you know, in the music industry, say 20 years ago when someone would record their record album and put it onto cassette so they could listen to their car, or they borrow a record from someone and they do the same kind of thing. But they didn't really, the industry didn't really get after people for that. Is it just a matter of they're seeing losses in their bottom line these days, and it's an easier technology? You know, sort of, could you speak about that a little bit? I'd appreciate it.
Sure.
Thank you very much, caller. Yeah, Pat Ofterhardy?
Yes, I think that's it's a great question, and it's an important thing to distinguish the issues. It's an important thing to distinguish the problem with business models from copyright, because I do think that the large mass media industries are using copyright as a way to punish their customers in a way. And you know, when you're at a point in a business where, you know, you take your customer as your enemy, that's you've really reached a crisis. But basically, and it's important to distinguish downloading, which is copying whatever, for whatever reason, you're copying the whole thing, from fair use, which would be repurposing the part of it that you need. Now, sometimes that is 100%, but you'd have a real clear reason to do it. There's a bunch of reasons why you might want to download, copy, and share that are really traditional things that you used to be able to do in analog, like, you know, I want to read I want to read this book. I want to share it with my friends. When I'm done with it, I want to pass it along to somebody. And you might say to yourself, "Hey, that's why can't I do that in a digital environment? If somebody hasn't encrypted it, to get impossible, or created a device for me like the Apple that makes it, the iPod that makes it impossible to transfer." The reason why the industry people are so hysterical about downloading is pretty obvious, because they have avoided trying to figure out how to develop business models that suit that incredibly easy-to-use technology. I mean, at this point, is there anybody under 70 who isn't downloading? And the reason we're all downloading is because it's easy, it's efficient, it's good. So the mass media industries have been slow to pick up on the fact that it is the future, and they haven't developed their business models, so they're going to try to punish people for using them.
No, Pat Ofterhardy, let me interrupt you for a second on that point. And I don't want to talk about journalism now. We've talked about that a lot on this program, and I've written about it. But I'd like to talk...
And by the way, I'm loving your new book.
Well, thank you very much. Everyone, that's why Pat Ofterhardy is one of the great geniuses of our time. I'm more interested in talking about the music industry and film industry and the entertainment industries and book publishing, too. Because I think their argument, if I get it, and I might be wrong, but at least their concern, if not argument, their deep-seated concern is that digital technologies really destroy their business model. They don't have one.
They do destroy their business model.
But, I mean, not just their model, their business, period. There really isn't a commercial industry that can, you know, produce and sell music and make profits in the digital world, without like extraordinarily strict copyright protection, that this technology has just basically eliminated any of these industries' existence ultimately. Do you buy that? And if that's true, what do we do?
Well, I do think that the question is very different if you're outside the industry and if you're inside the industry. Nobody promised these guys inside the industry a business model that would last forever. And presently, they're configured in a very middle management heavy way with lots and lots and lots and lots of vice presidents to do something laboriously large parts of which now take very little work. So I would argue that you don't need to structure those businesses that way at all, that there's lots of new ways that people are making money. The people at Ticketmaster really, really get that the new money is in live performance and controlling access to venues. And I think that Ticketmaster is, along with Google and Amazon and a couple of other folks, the one of the great new gatekeepers of our time. I don't think that the fact that we have these new digital capacities necessarily means that it's a new era for democracy. I think that depends on whether we're going to use it the right way. But it does mean you restructure those businesses so that the painful part for the current entertainment industry and the current journalism business is not that we won't have music anymore or we won't have movies or we won't have journalism, but it doesn't need to be structured with the behemoths that currently exist. And the reason why it's hard for them to get over that is all those vice presidents. I mean, that's my view anyway.
Well, I want to touch on this a little bit more, but first let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest again, Pat Osterheide from the Center for Social Media. If you'd like to join us here at WILL on Media Matters, the phone number 333-9455, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We're talking copyright, the internet, fair use, public domain, all the issues about this technological revolution and the sort of legal superstructure, which is in serious conflict with it at times. Let's go now back to line one. Champagne, you're on the air with Pat Osterheide.
Hi. I heard your discussion about downloading music, and there's a question that's kind of haunted me. Years and years ago, decades ago, when cassette tapes were big, I probably bought, 200 albums worth of stuff on cassette, all of which disintegrated. And I wonder if there are any cases where people have downloaded music that they bought before where the storage of the music is actually destroyed because it just wasn't designed to last, and what the industry's stance on that is. It's like they're basically saying with the downloads, well, we own this music. You can't steal a copy of it because you're still stealing from it. But I think it reverses in the case that I'm talking about, but I have no idea what the legal ramifications are.
Thank you very much, caller. Yeah, Pat Osterheide?
I am not what you said prompted a set of thoughts in me, and I'm not sure that they're exactly going to be the same thing as what you asked, but I hope so. First of all, this question of format is really huge. The really stable formats are the really old ones. We have really great records of when people have carved on stone. That stuff lasts a long time. Really good paper also lasts a really long time. That would not be any of the recent paper since the 19th century. Vinyl is actually a very durable form. But all of the digital formats are transient in a way that is shocking even to the recent past, because you have, for instance, in video right now, online video, a variety of incompatible video formats that you could upload in, and each one of them is constantly being upgraded. So one of the to get back to the discussion Bob and I were having at the beginning of the hour, the question of public policies and what do we need? In terms of preservation, one of the things we need is really good libraries. And this is something where the good funding that European libraries have in comparison with the U.S., I think, is important to note. There is a lot of work and thought going into how do we preserve digital records well. I do want to point out that one of the ways in which fair use is employable, eligible, is when you are trying to preserve something that otherwise will get lost. I hope that addresses some of what you raised.
Well, let me ask a little bit of a follow-up then to your comments just now, Pat. Let's say President Obama and Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid called you up and said, you know, we listened to you on that McChesney show and we think you're really smart and we want to redo copyright law in America. We've really got a law that doesn't really fit in with the current technologies and needs of the people. What changes would you recommend for copyright law if you were given the option to do that?
I would love to get that phone call, and then I would like to have them say one other thing. And we'd really like to develop this law, but excluding the large content industries from the negotiations, because at this point, any kind of legal change will involve so much pressure from large content holders that the situation will get even worse, which is why I keep going back to what we can do in non-legal ways, and particularly by using our fair use rights. But if they did ask me,
the important thing I would say is
cut the scope of copyright back.
Mm-hmm.
Make it be something that allows a truly limited monopoly. Make it be for a shorter amount of time. Make it be for fewer things. And make it be for just those things and not every derivative work that was ever made out of them. And then, before you do any of that, in fact, get rid of statutory damages. Get rid of the overwhelming hundreds of thousands of dollars of penalties that can sometimes be attached to making a copyright mistake. Because that, we actually have, fair use is such a flexible and powerful policy that if we did not have statutory damages scaring the heck out of people, we'd be in a better space.
Pat, do me a favor, Pat Alfieri, put a little meat on those bones. What do you mean by statutory damages? Give me an example of how that works.
Right. Statutory damage, it says, if you're found to infringe on somebody's copyright, you used it and you didn't ask their permission or pay them, and you should have paid them, fair use did not apply, then you can be you might be liable for up to $150,000 per infringement. So perhaps you quoted for something and there were three copyright holders involved. You could have $150,000. You could be liable for $150,000 per infringement for each of those three.
So basically, it's the death penalty for your parking ticket.
Yes, exactly. But the reality is that it's extremely unlikely that you would get remotely close to anything like that. But the fact that the law is on the books means that they can send you those letters that say, hey, you have to cease and desist doing whatever you're doing, or you might be liable for $150,000. And even if you yourself know that that's kind of a bogus claim and that's never going to happen to you, if your boss sees that letter or your client sees that letter, you know, they're going to be scared.
Well, it's what First Amendment lawyers call the chilling effect.
Exactly. In fact, there's a great website called The Chilling Effect that describes some of these cease and desist letters.
Our guest is Pat Osterheide. We're talking copyright, fair use, the Internet, and what's happening in this technological revolution and documentary film. Let's go back to our phone lines now to our next caller, Champaign County, Line 1. You're on the air with Pat Osterheide.
Hi. On the hypothetical scenario you just gave and your answer, I was just thinking, are there any reasons to believe that the Obama administration is going to be less of compliant to large corporate interests? I mean, if communication policy goes the way of healthcare policy, you know, we'll just have another catastrophe, it seems to me. And do you think there's any chance that those major players you referred to will be limited in their, I obviously power doesn't cave without a demand or something, and I don't know whether there's more people working for communication policy than healthcare policy, but it does seem like a rather plaintive note. Is there any?
Well, I think Bob has given you not only in his recent book but in earlier books some wonderful examples of how much money is being poured into communication and telecommunication policy by lobbyists. But I think a couple of things. First of all, there is extremely remote chance of any significant legislation on copyright and communication issues because all of the stakeholders right now are frozen. They're all looking at each other in a circle, and nobody wants to do anything because nobody can figure out what the new business models are yet. And when they do figure that out, then people will know with whom they should align for what policy. But right now, since nobody knows what they want yet, even really sensible, easy-to-get kinds of legislative changes that are impossible. For instance, there's something called orphan works, which is you want to use a copyrighted work. You even want to license it. You want to pay for it, but you can't find the owner. This is a really easy thing to get to go on because everybody, including copyright industries and non-copyright industries, could all agree that it's a good idea to be able to figure out some way to allow people to continue their work with this situation. But you can't even pass that. So I don't think we're going to see a situation that will get better legally real soon. But on the other hand, I don't think it's going to get worse real soon either, because I think not much will happen. And once again, this is why I go back to the citizen action stuff of expanding in practice the rights we have, because it is an area where in this interim period when the business models are squishy, you can actually do something to improve the situation.
Pat Ofter, Heidi, our guest, the head of the Center for Social Media at American University. We've only got a few minutes left, but time for another caller. If someone does want to call in at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. I should add that, Pat, that I was the one who asked the hypothetical question about changing copyright law in Congress. You didn't suggest there was any chance of that. That was just my hypothetical to get a sense of what a sane and rational copyright regime would look like. If we had one that accorded to our technologies.
Well, you know, there's something that I think does change the picture in the cold, ruthless, ugly world of actual politics, mm-hmm. which is that there's a rising group of industries that require fair work to do their work that changes the stakeholder mm-hmm. mix. Because Google right now, an extremely powerful economic actor and gradually becoming a significant political stakeholder.
Mm-hmm.
Google absolutely depends on fair use, and it depends on lots of different kinds of fair use.
Hmm.
And
yeah,
they have won lawsuits. People who are in Google's situation have won lawsuits that show that copyright law must be relaxed, particularly around fair use. The interpretation has to favor them. The other part of the American business environment that's pro-lowered copyright and particularly pro-fair use is the equipment manufacturers, the people who produce small electronics, because everybody who produces an MP3 player, you know, every device you've got, wants their customers to be able to do with it what they want to do with it. And to have the environment be fraught such that as your callers demonstrate, you know, are you going to be able to download this, and am I going to be able to exchange it with people? Can I do something reasonable like make a copy for my car? These questions...
Mm-hmm.
You know, have to be answered affirmatively and flexibly for the equipment manufacturer's business to grow. So I think that there's a possibility not only of citizen action to be activists for better legislation at some time in the future, not now, because not right now it's just a mess.
Yeah, but that's a very important point you're making about the changing balance of commercial forces maybe opening up some space that hasn't been there for the last 50 years or so.
Exactly. And this is a direct consequence of the change from a mass media environment to a networked participatory environment.
If you want to find some of the material that Pat Osterheide and her organization, the Center for Social Media, have done on this issue on copyright and fair use, as well as a lot of other stuff on documentary film, on media literacy, on public media, just go to their website at centerforsocialmedia.org, centerforsocialmedia.org. Pat, we've only got a few minutes left, and there's something I wanted to ask you about, because the website has a wealth of material, and I reviewed it this last week before the show, and we've only touched on a smattering, if that, of the material that's there and that your group has worked on. And one of the interesting questions that's come up a lot in the last month or two and other frameworks is this whole question of whether the internet, and I think it's fair to say from the tenor of our conversation today that you're enthusiastic about some of the democratic potential of the internet and the new technologies and some of the benefits of them. But there's a concurrent critique of the internet that's developed in digital technologies that sort of draws from the legendary communication scholar Neil Postman, that these technologies in combination with commercial forces are actually dumbing us down and making us less literate. And frankly, I think the argument in its more vulgar sense or boiled down, that we're making us dumber. And I know that you've done a lot of work in media literacy. What do you make of that argument? Is there anything to it? How do you deal with that when it comes up?
I actually believe that argument is... can't be substantiated when you really get down and do the work. I think people were worried about the internet makes you lonely and it makes you only talk to your own, but in fact, the best evidence is it points exactly in the other direction of socialization. People are worried about a nation of ADD, but actually this is the first generation that's ever gotten any help for ADD. I would not want to give the human race any points for being any smarter than we are. But I'm not sure that we're dumber than we used to be. What I'm concerned about with the internet is I think that new gatekeepers are very quickly emerging. And what I would not want to do is to have people be looking through rose-colored glasses at the democratizing and participatory aspect, the democratizing features of the participation, because I think we can also participate in commercial activities and in activities that are not democratic, and that's overwhelmingly likely. And just to add one more thing to the pot, the issue of our own cable companies and our own internet companies controlling what we can do on the internet through the lack of net neutrality is one example.
Just a final point of that, because Postman's argument was that television didn't make the same demands upon our brains that reading and writing did, and then our brains in effect became lazier and we became less.
However, most people weren't even reading.
Okay, well, I'm not here to make Neil's argument for him, but rather, I mean, to extend it, some people say, well, the internet just extends that sort of anti-literate culture. Others say that the interactivity of it actually is radically different from television. I assume you're falling in the latter camp.
Yeah, I would say that people are writing more and more actively creating their own culture than they have done for at least the last 75 years.
Speaking of creating culture, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to kick me out of the studio, Pat Osterheide.
This has been fun, Bob. Thank you so much.
It's been my great pleasure. We've had Pat Osterheide today joining us for the full hour talking about copyright, intellectual property, the internet, and fair use. To learn more about her work and the work of her group, go to centerforsocialmedia.org. I want to thank Kyle Kroha for being my engineer today, and Melissa Trentz, as always, for being producer. I'm Bob McChesney. We'll be back in 167 hours. Have a great week, everyone.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, rain is likely this afternoon with a high of 49 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy with patchy fog after midnight, a low of 35. Partly sunny on Monday with a high of 52. Monday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 40. And rain returns on Tuesday with a high of 51. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.